today. As we approach the end of Black History Month, the mayor of Bristol describes how a bus boycott in his city back in the 1950s changed the course of race relations in Britain. And we'll hear from Syrian filmmaker Waad Al-Katiab on why she stayed for years in the besieged city of Aleppo. Marvin Rees is the first directly elected black mayor of any British city. An ambition that would have seemed impossible half a century ago when his father first travelled from Jamaica to Bristol.
You know, my dad, like a lot of people coming in the 1950s and 60s, had to get tough quite quickly because that was the reality of it. It was not just a cultural change, it was a physical challenge coming to the UK, not just in terms of cold, but in terms of the threat of violence.
And it wasn't just a threat of violence facing black people back then, but a terrible lack of opportunity caused by outright racism. The discrimination against black applicants to be bus drivers and conductors in Bristol led to a boycott that would tear down the policy and become a key turning point in the fight for race equality. And yet, for decades, this story, like so many others of black history, was hardly told.
Well, I didn't hear about the boycott when I was growing up. I think there was a real reluctance in the city to recognise the bus boycott in its history.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the mayor of Bristol on the boycott that helped transform his city. This episode has one instance in which we give an example of extremely shocking and racist language. Your mum's white and born here in the UK, and your dad came as part of the Windrush generation from Jamaica. When he arrived here, and as he grew up, what was the city like?
Bristol became a very segregated city. Although actually, it offers on a number of levels, because obviously my mum tells a story of back in the day when the blues clubs like Bamboo and, you know, the house parties were going on. She said there was an amazing culture because that's what Jamaicans brought. She said you can go to any dance, you could dance with anyone, you know, people weren't getting drugs, you know, weren't loads of drugs and alcohol around, and it was very music based and social. She said there was something really thriving about that which drew her to it and drew lots of other people to it. So there was a street level community story playing itself out in Bristol where people were coming together across what you might call cultural, racial, ethnic boundaries, and I'm obviously the physical product of that coming together in the most ultimate form. So that was going on, but there's a context around it as well in which Asians coming and West Indians coming were focused in the inner city around St. Paul's primarily, and then obviously some spillover into Eastern. So there's that social segregation that was going on.
Was it hard for people of colour to find somewhere to live in the city?
Yeah, it was very hard for people of colour to find places to live. We got that classic history of no blacks, no Irish and no dogs, you know, in the signs. And then that actually spilled over into my mum, because as I've shared, my mum, 1972, white woman, unmarried, very little money, brown baby on the way. Before I was born, she was coming under pressure to have me aborted. And then when I was born, she was told if she was a good woman, she'd have me adopted. And then that spilled over into her, you know, her housing options, as it were, you know, to turn up as a woman like this, with this brown child and trying to get somewhere to live. So she lived on City Road as well, with a large number of Jamaican community back then.
Have either your mum or dad ever told you how that made them feel?
My dad didn't tell me how it makes him feel. My dad, like a lot of people of, if I can say, Jamaicans of that era, he didn't sit down and said, oh, this makes me feel sad. You know, in many ways, they fought back. They carved out their space. My mum doesn't sit down and say, this is how I felt through the process. But clearly, you know, I've heard stories. I watched her being insulted by people. She does tell the story, actually, of when we lived in... We had a council flat down in Lawrence Weston, which is a very white housing estate on the edge of town. We were there in the 1970s. I was the only kid in my school that wasn't white at the time, which is an interesting experience as well. And a political activist was coming around getting votes, and he propositioned my mum because the assumption was a white woman with a brown baby was in prostitution. He made that proposition to her, and you know, if you want some help, I'll come back with some money. These things land, don't they? You know, because you know, I guess you're feeling that people look down on you and think you're worth less. It actually, when I gave my State of the City just a couple of years ago, I said to mum, you know, who would have thought, you know, back all those days ago that your son would turn out to be mayor of the city. And that wasn't a boastful statement, but it was looking back on the challenges we went through growing up, and now I've ended up the mayor of Bristol.
Now, why have you come to England?
To seek a job.
And what sort of job do you want?
Any type, so long as I get a good pay.
In the early 1950s, highly skilled immigrants arriving in the city were met with little opportunity, and deliberately so.
Bristol, seaport, university town, industrial centre, whatever you care to call it, it's crowded and full of people on the move. People who have to queue for the bus and don't like it.
One of the major employers, which ran bus services in Bristol, Bath and much of Gloucestershire, had an unstated policy of discrimination. What was the so-called colour bar?
Well, a colour bar for Bristol Omnibus Company was an overt decision, policy of not employing black and Asian people in their bus crews, and having a whole set of assertions around that women wouldn't feel safe with them, that the white people wouldn't work with black people, that the customers wouldn't want to work with black or Asian employees. And so they set out a collusion between the company, the local authority, and the unions to exclude black and Asian people from the job opportunities.
It seems weird to us now to think that the union movement back then, the Transport and General Workers Union, passed a resolution that said people of colour should not be employed as bus crews. In one quote, there was a suggestion the union had said, if one black man steps on the platform as a conductor, every wheel will stop. Why were they so against some workers' rights?
They would have been a reflection of their time. They would have been a reflection of the arguments and the feelings of many of their members.
They start ruling the country before long, won't they?
What would you think about coloured people coming to work on the buses?
I don't like the idea very much.
Why not?
I wouldn't like to work with them at night.
Well, I think majority of them are just ignorant.
I guess they would have bought into the narrative that these Asians and black people were taking the jobs of their existing members or driving down wages. All these things would have been floated down, and no institution, even those that would, you know, on the tin say they're fighting for social progress, is immune to replicating the racial and class hierarchies of the society in which they work. And the unions at the time were part of that.
When all this was going on, what was the incentive for people of colour in Bristol to become a bus driver?
I mean, it would have been like people would be looking at steady work, and pensions, the whole thing that goes with people wanting to have jobs. I'd imagine the number of people turned up here very qualified and then thought, well, actually, I can't get in there. And the bus company had jobs, just wouldn't give them to them.
Can you tell me about the West Indian Development Council?
When the community came to Bristol and settled, people needed to come together because they didn't find any institutions that were looking out for their interests. And when the institutions of a place aren't looking out for your interests, you have to come together and begin to set your own goals and take care of your own community. And that's where this kind of organization comes from. Just that drive to say, no one's going to do it for us. We have to do it for and with ourselves.
The group was initially formed by four young West Indian men, Roy Hackett, Owen Henry, Audley Evans and Prince Brown, who wanted to step up action against discrimination in Bristol. They teamed up with a local social worker and civil rights campaigner called Paul Stevenson, who devised a plan that he believed would prove that the company was operating a colour bar. They decided to put forward Guy Reed Bailey for a job as a bus conductor.
It was Paul that had called the bus company to get an interview for a guy, and Paul describes he was born in England, over in Essex, and you know, spoke very English, so they wouldn't have known he was black. So he phoned up Guy Reed-Bailey, went for interview, and they met him. They said, "Oh, sorry, no jobs for you."
When I got into the reception, the lady at the time, I can remember, said to the manager, "Oh, the 2 o'clock appointment is here," something to that effect, and he's black. And I heard the manager said something like, "Tell him all the vacancies are taken and there's no more." And that was that. I was very disappointed.
And that really was a pivotal piece of evidence that they were able to then put on the table and expose the colour bar that everyone knew was there anyway.
So what did they do?
When there was no response from the Bristol Omnibus Company and the unions, they organised a boycott of the buses. And obviously, the large number of black and Asian people in the city traveling to work by bus, this would have been not just significant in terms of the numbers, but significant in terms of the symbolism. And that's what began to draw a lot of national and international attention to what was going on in Bristol.
At the time, was there support among the public for the boycott, or were there people who spoke out against it?
Well, there were people speaking out against it because obviously there was a resistance to it, but people, you know, institutions don't always change because you're making an argument that is morally upright.
The point is that whilst we can obtain white labour in this city, we intend to go on engaging white labour rather than coloured labour.
So the company dug in, but students from Bristol University held a protest march. The local MP, Tony Benn...
Paul Stevenson got in touch with me.
..contacted Labour leader Harold Wilson...
And, I rang up Harold
..who
Wilson.
..spoke out about the colour bar. What happened?
So the results weren't immediate, and obviously there were many months of negotiations between the community, local authority, politicians, unions and the company. But obviously, what came out of that was that black and Asian people got jobs in the Bristol Omnibus Company.
That was the short-term impact, but this had a much bigger ripple effect, didn't it?
The boycott lasted for about 4 months, but the legacy went on. People say it was, you know, a real catalyst for the Race Relations Act of 1965, which made racial discrimination unlawful in public places. Also, the Race Relations Act 1968, which extended the provisions of that.
In Britain, the government has produced its Race Relations Bill. Among other things, it's designed to ban discrimination in the sale or renting of houses.
And obviously these two pieces of legislation, you know, beginning to set a pattern of behaviour, a trajectory, recognising that the national government does have a role, and racism should not be seen as something that you can just indulge in, particularly when you're locking people out of economic opportunity.
If you believe yourself a victim of racial discrimination, or you know of a case, get advice from a Citizens Advice Bureau or the Race Relations Board, St. Stephen's House, Victoria Embankment, London SW1.
You said you never knew about the boycott as a child. Did your parents not talk to you about it?
They probably would have known about it, but unless, you know, unless there's a kind of public acknowledgement of it, you wouldn't necessarily go and tell the story every year when there was a bus boycott. The experiences of black and Asian people in Bristol was not something that was taught, grappled with by the city.
The decades that followed were not always calm. In the 1980s, there were riots in Bristol.
Incredibly, it happened. In an English street, a bank was burnt out by rioters. The riot propelled St. Paul's Bristol into the headlines.
How old were you then, and how did you deal with that as someone who was mixed race?
I was about 9 when the first riot kicked off. I was actually out. I was in the first year of my junior school, and I was out inviting kids to my birthday party. We didn't have a phone in our house, so we did it on foot back then. So we were walking around, and I was on the bottom of Ashley Road. And I can remember hearing this you know, whirl of noise, and a police car drove over a bottle, and a piece of a tiny fragment of glass flew off and hit me in the forehead. Because I can remember my dad coming around later that night and checking my eyebrows for glass. But it was a challenging time. I mean, I experienced the full racism of Bristol through the 80s and through the second riots, collection of riots as well. You know, I was aware of people being treated differently. Part of my own political motivation was, my own worldview, my priorities in politics is born out of those experiences. But I've also described at the same time, I went home in the middle of all this racism. I'm a mixed race man, and my primary caring family are white. So I lived this interesting straddling across race and class divisions.
Racism still exists. No one's saying for a second that it doesn't, but it is a different world to the one you were growing up in and the one before that your dad arrived in. And in 2009, the people you've mentioned, Paul Stevenson, Bailey and Hackett, were awarded OBEs for their part in organising the bus boycott. Do you remember how you felt when you found out about that?
I was very proud of them. I'm very proud of Paul and Roy and Guy, all these forerunners, because I just don't think people can fully appreciate how much strength and resilience it takes to hold it together, to get out of bed every day with hope, trying to make the world better when a whole system is railed against you and allies are few and far between. They've served this country phenomenally and displayed incredible amounts of strength and resilience, and I just have the greatest admiration for that. I would say on racism is an interesting thing. It does change, but it's also the same. People still get killed. People are still excluded from opportunity. You know, if I can share, someone posted on my own Facebook the other day, this is what you get when you put a nigger in charge after my State of the City speech.
Oh my God, how did that make you feel?
Well, I, in terms of verbal name calling, I have to be very careful the way I describe this. In some sense, it doesn't matter to me, right? Because I'm the mayor of the city. I got a couple of master's degrees. I have things around me that give me protection from feeling vulnerable to that kind of name calling. But what I am very aware of is that not everyone has that. And in fact, when I was talking to someone about this over the weekend, they were talking about some young kids they knew that were being called the N-word by people on a touchline during a football match. And they didn't have the wherewithal to cope with it because they hadn't had the chance to build up the resources that would allow them to just blow off and resist that name and everything it implied about their own worthlessness.
What amazes me is that it seems that the Bristol bus boycott is a critical part of British history, and yet it's relatively unknown. I know people are teaching it now in Bristol, but you didn't know about it as a child. I didn't know about it as a child. And yet, on the very day that Ian Paty, who was the general manager of the Bristol Omnibus Company, announced that there will be no more discrimination in employing bus crews,
I have a dream and one thing.
Martin Luther King made the most famous speech about racial discrimination ever known, I Have a Dream. It was August the 28th, 1963.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
We all know what he said. Why is it that this important part of British black history, the Bristol bus boycott, is less well known?
Well, I'd say the UK just has not really grappled with the contribution that black people have made to its history in a way that the United States has. And so it is shocking to think that actually the bus boycott really came to prominence only in this century, really. Despite efforts, and there was actually overt resistance to talking about this, as well as there's been overt resistance to understanding the role of the trade in people, the transatlantic slave trade, played in the origins of Bristol's economic wealth as well. And I guess there's no interest. There wasn't felt to be an audience, and there wasn't felt to have done any good. And there was a misunderstanding as well that this was about guilt. To me, this is just about being good quality historians and telling, having a proper understanding of who we are and how we got to be who we are and where we are. And I don't even like to call it, it is black history, but actually it's our history, right? Just like the Vikings' history is part of British history as well. You can't tell the history of Britain without talking about Vikings, right? So I think people are taking it into account because it's half a story. And what they say, you know, I saw someone every day, you know, half a truth is a whole lie.
And how has being inspired by the individuals you're talking about and by understanding and learning about some of these events from Bristol's history, how has that played into your own aspirations and your own career?
Well, all these stories of the people that have gone before are incredibly inspirational and motivating. On one level, as I've said to Paul and I've said to Roy, you know, I wouldn't be here if they hadn't done what they'd done. You know, my life doesn't exist in an abstract. I didn't just pop out and become mayor. I'm building on things. I took advantage of opportunities that came about because of what that generation did. But also, that's part of my aspiration for fairness and equality. And I certainly want to make sure that other people from disadvantaged backgrounds and black backgrounds, Asian backgrounds, those communities and those groups that are underrepresented in leadership, women as well, get those opportunities, because we are creating a city in which the circumstances of your birth are not by far and away the biggest determinant of where you end up in life, which at the moment is a reality, not just for Bristol, but for the country.
That was the Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees. Coming up, co-director of new documentary for SAMA, Waad Al-Khatiab, on raising a child in a city under siege. Now, the siege of Aleppo has been one of the worst moments of the Syrian conflict to date, and the images of devastated neighbourhoods are hard to forget. Despite the relentless shelling, filmmaker Waad Al-Khatiab, co-director of the award-winning new documentary for SAMA, remained in the city for years, giving birth to a daughter and raising her in unimaginable conditions. Here she explains why she stayed.
I want to ask everyone to think personally. If your house is on fire and all your family are inside, and there's just one door behind you, will you just run away and leave them all? Or will you stay and try to keep everyone safe? Aleppo is the place where I went to the university and started dreaming about my future, the place where I felt in love, the place where I got married and I had my first child, the place where I felt that I really became a human being, the place where I knew that at any moment I could have been killed, and I decided to stay. You can't separate yourself from the public. All of us, we have that responsibility. Aleppo is my home. If in the most difficult situation we left, who will stay? Who will keep fighting for our freedom and our future? I know that could seem very crazy for many people, but at the same time, I wasn't alone. There was 300,000 people in the siege of Aleppo. Most of these people have a chance before to leave, but we all decided to stay. Hamza was a doctor, my husband, and I am a journalist. Both of us have a huge role to play at that place. We knew very clearly that anyone who could do one small thing, that will really make a difference. There was no safe place in Aleppo. The shelling was 24 hours. We've experienced a lot of difficult situation, and we felt many times that our life could be ended at any moment. It was so hard to decide in every minute that I need to stand to smile, and you need to look at the people around you, and all the time pretend that everything is okay. I had thousands of questions who I was asking myself all the time. Should I stay or should I leave? Should I protect my daughter and think just about us? Should I forget everything we went through in the first year of the revolution? The strength that I have, and I think many of us had at that time, was from the belief that what we are doing is the right thing. When you have two sides, one of them criminals who is killing people, and the other side people who, with their resilience, is fighting these crimes, you feel that this is really important to be there and to stand with the right things in this world. We were all the time trying to live our life normally as any human being around the world. We have birthdays, we have weddings. Even under the very bad circumstances, we were trying to create that love and that joy. And that's one of the things which is make us survive until now. Whatever my personal emotional was in one moment, when I'm seeing the one next to me have that bad situation, I find strength. I've never felt that I have it before. And the same things, like when I feel that I really broke down and I couldn't do that anymore, I found a great support from the people around me. I think this kind of resilience is a human being thing. It's beyond Aleppo, it's beyond Syria. It's something, I think everyone who had bad circumstances, they try to find a hope. Maybe I lost everything, but I'm still fighting with this film. And just remember that this is still happening.
You can watch Al-Katiab's award-winning documentary For Sama on All4. My thanks to her and to Marvin Rees. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Chika Ayres and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.